Another day, another ministry confirming job cuts.
Hundreds of public servants have today been told they could soon be out of a job as the Coalition's promised cuts begin to bite.
Wellington is taking a hit, with hundreds of public service staff set to lose their jobs. Just this week, a total of 760 job cuts have been announced by the Ministry of Health, the Ministry of Primary Industries and the Ministry of Business. Dozens more ministries are due to strip back their budgets as directed by the government.
Brutal, chaotic and dangerous. That's one characterisation of today's public sector job cuts as the axe fell on more than 1,000 roles. 565 are at the Ministry of Education, the rest at Oranga Tamariki. The government insists savings will be spent on frontline services.
When you talk to New Zealanders, they do not want to see waste in our public services.
My heart goes out to anyone who loses their job in any circumstances, but no government can live beyond its means indefinitely.
These cuts are reckless, and the government is doing so with no plan.
Kia ora, I'm Tom Kitchen, and today on The Detail, the cutting back of the public sector. What's the government's plan here? And how badly will the job losses hit our capital city? We'll start today with RNZ's Digital Explainer editor Katie Kenny for an overview. Firstly, what exactly do we mean by the public sector?
That's probably a good place to start, yes. The public sector refers to a broad range, literally thousands of organisations that serve as instruments of the Crown. So it's separated into the central government or the state and the local government. And then within central government, you've got the public service, those core 39 departments, ministries that you would recognise and kind of those things that people automatically think, okay, that's where public servants work. You know, that workforce of nearly 66,000 full-time staff is measured by the Public Service Commission workforce data, and that's the workforce that was explicitly targeted by these government cuts. National had campaigned on slashing back office expenditure as part of its back pocket boost tax plan.
Across the whole of the agencies, with some exceptions, we actually think there's a real need to go through all those elements of spending and stop the dumb, stupid, wasteful stuff that's driving so much bureaucracy.
And in December, Finance Minister Nicola Willis said she wanted to reduce public spending by $1.5 billion annually. She asked those core public service agencies to identify savings of either 6.5 or 7%, depending on their previous growth.
Agencies will be given targets of how much savings they should find, and we've asked them to look, what do you have that's a program that's no longer delivering what it's set out to, that's no longer aligned with coalition priorities, or are there areas where you could have better efficiency, better productivity, and therefore reduce the cost of what you're doing?
So think, yeah, major ministries like education, health, social development and so on. But even before that, you know, a lot of those core public service agencies had been asked to find savings through cutting back on various things. And what we're now seeing is kind of cuts at Crown entities, WorkSafe and Callaghan Innovation and Crown Research Institute, NIWA, for example. So we're actually reporting quite deep cuts at some of those smaller Crown entities that function at arm's length from the government.
Are we mostly seeing those back office cuts, or has the front line crept into it too?
The directive was for back office cuts. The Finance Minister, Nicola Willis, has said frontline staff won't be cut. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that in some cases, frontline is difficult to define.
Do you want to have a go at defining frontline versus back office? It can't be complicated.
I think what people think about when they hear frontline staff are people who are not in that core public service workforce. They're thinking about teachers and doctors and police officers, social workers who work for other public sector departments but don't necessarily work for the Ministry of Health or the Ministry of Social Development as policy advisors. That's kind of the casual distinction that has been emphasised by the Finance Minister.
Now, Tracy Watkins, the editor of the Post and Sunday Star Times. She was Stuff's political editor for around 10 years, spending about double that at Parliament.
But I was in the press gallery from about 1997, so spent far too long wandering around the press gallery.
So this week we've seen headlines on your websites like Stuff and The Post, the top headlines saying more than 1,000 public sector jobs lost in one day. To me, it sounds unprecedented. But do you feel like that's right, or is it just a natural ebb and flow of left and right politics?
I think what's happened is we've had a period of quite a bit of stability in the public service for about the last 10, 15 years. I mean, 1,000 jobs in one day, it's staggering. It's particularly staggering in Wellington, you know, I think where everyone's reeling from a whole lot of bad news lately. So it feels more monumental in scale. But if you go back through the 1980s and then the 1990s, the public service numbers have really, really ebbed and flown. In fact, I was looking it up just to see, and I think back in 1993, they were talking about the fact that previous Labor government in the 1980s had obviously absolutely reformed the public service. Numbers in 1993 were 36,374 in the core public service, down from 70,000 10 years earlier. And I'm taking those numbers from a report done by Margaret Baisley, I think, a few years ago. And certainly at the time, it seemed bad. Anyone who lived through those times and those reforms will remember there were pretty dark days. There were huge swathes through the public service and the wider state sector. I think the difference is that it was a national story. It was nationwide. I think a lot of jobs were going, particularly in regional New Zealand, when you had sort of reform with things like the railways and a whole lot of other things. Here it feels very concentrated in Wellington. And I think, you know, that's why people are sort of reeling here in particular.
Did you say 70,000 back in the...
That was in the 1980s. So in the 1980s, we saw there was an incoming Labour government. A lot of the language was the same. And I think one of the quotes I dug out from David Longy was sort of saying that he called for the resignation of any departmental chief executive refusing to administer government policy. And Roger Douglas, who ended up being the finance minister, sort of asked the question, are government departments necessary? Are they doing the job? Can they be trimmed? Be ruthless with the answers. So this is not a new thing. The public service in Wellington has always been under scrutiny. And its numbers have always ebbed and flowed. Today, we saw 1,000 jobs go. That's against the backdrop of a public service that there's 65,000 is the number that has been talked about, compared with 50,000 in 2018. And in fact, if you want to go back further to when the, you know, the key government was voted out, they had the numbers capped at 38,000, 39,000. This stage, what we're seeing in Wellington isn't anywhere near as big as some of those big, huge cuts of the past. But obviously, this is a rolling program. This is actually just getting started. So there's a lot more to come.
What I want to do now is just talk about what happened in since 2017 to the last 6 years under the Labor-led governments. What was their reasoning for increasing the public service staff numbers so much?
I mean, the argument was always COVID. One, that they were addressing an imbalance under the Key government where things got too run down and the numbers have been stripped back too far. And then the other argument they used was because of COVID, there was just a whole lot of other extra work to do. I think if you delve into that too much, you'd probably find that part of that was just simply keeping jobs open, purely from an economic point of view. But I think most people would accept that. Sure, COVID required some extra resource, but probably not the, I think it was a 15% increase in staffing levels under COVID. We saw numbers rise from 50,000 public servants to 65,000 public servants, but probably more crucially, particularly from Nicola Willis's point of view, is that the wage bill rose up to $6.1 billion, up from sort of around the $3 billion mark, which is a huge increase.
It sounds like the public service may be a little bit bloated?
I think bloated is such a loaded word, isn't it? And I think it's one that I try to avoid because it's a political word. So I don't think there'd be too many people who would disagree that there could certainly be some trimming. And let's face it, everyone else is doing that. You know, we in the media have done it.
Well, what a week for the media, but not in a good way. Unprecedented cuts to TV news and the loss of hundreds of journalist jobs at both our big TV broadcasters.
It's been a brutal time for a lot of people in business. They're all cutting their costs. They're cutting staff. A lot of them are closing their doors. It's not like anyone can be immune to that.
So it's an economic thing as well. It's not just a philosophical right-wing view.
No, I mean, it's definitely not ideological. And a lot of the people that I've talked to would also count themselves as pretty staunchly Labour, but they would also privately admit that there had been too much fat built into the system. But I don't think it's ideological for the government to look at the state of the books and say, we actually need to find savings. There has to be money found somewhere. I think we can all accept things are looking grim, and it's, you know, there does need to be some balancing of the books somehow. And obviously this is one way in which the government can do that. The question is whether you go too far and you run down services, etc. And we're just not going to know that at this stage.
Do you think this actually makes sense, like these cuts make sense when there's the cost of redundancy, which is so big?
The cost of slashing public servants at a single government department has already exceeded $6 million. The total cost of redundancies across the public service is not yet known, and the finance minister has not asked for an estimated price tag.
It's a recurring cost, though, isn't it, a wage bill, whereas redundancy is just a one-off cost. From a financial point of view, yeah, redundancies will be a one-off hit, but after that you don't have the recurring annual cost.
But even if they end up using these staff who go and work for other agencies and then they're employed back as contractors, potentially at higher rates.
Yeah, and that has always been the argument about what tends to happen in Wellington as we go through these huge rounds of cuts, and then what happens is everyone ends up being hired back as contractors. And we have seen that in the past, and a lot of that happened during the years when the Key government was capping the public service numbers. We saw that the public service is getting around that by hiring contractors. What I would hope about this then is that when the government, you know, the government's been talking about this line by line review of spending, which they're asking the chief executives to do, is that they're looking at it and thinking about it from the point of view of, is what they're doing providing value? And I'll give you one example, which is that I would going to write an editorial about the Road to Zero, and I couldn't find a date. You know, this is the thing where they were going to cut road deaths to zero.
The previous government's nationwide Road to Zero plan, which started in 2020, was supposed to see an incremental reduction in road deaths, but didn't meet its forecasts.
I couldn't find a date for when it was actually supposed to be, we were going to hit zero road deaths, and so I was Googling everything and going through, and I found the website and started looking at it. I ended up finding a website and I found a whole bunch of the documents, which were quite high production values. And I can't remember how many there were, but there was more than one, 80 to 100 pages long, talking about this Road to Zero policy. And I couldn't for the life of me think, who is this for? Who's going to be reading this? Apart from me, who was desperately searching for one date. And I couldn't find the date, actually, as a result of all the searching, and I got tired of reading all the documents. They were beautiful production values, obviously very good writers employed doing it, talking about all these laudable goals and all the wonderful people involved in this Road to Zero policy. And it was like, but I just still couldn't figure out who the audience was. I think the audience was simply the minister. And I think that's the sort of thing that when I look at, I don't think they've really put a value beside a lot of the work that they're doing.
Roger Partridge is the chair of business-funded think tank the New Zealand Initiative. He's been looking really closely at the numbers of public service workers.
Today's figure at 65,699 is eye-wateringly large. So there's been an explosion, really, over the last 6 years. Dig deep into the numbers, we can see that the biggest increases are in the roles that are not frontline. So, for example, the number of managers in the public service grew from 5,333 when the Labour-led government took office in 2017 to over 8,000 in June last year.
Right.
The number of policy analysts increased from 2,633 to 3,949, an increase of 50%. And the number of information professionals grew from 5,400 to over 9,500.
What's an information professional?
They're somebody that deals with data. Over that period, of course, we've seen a big rise in automation. So you might have thought there would be an opportunity for savings in the size of the bureaucracy, but actually the scale of the bureaucracy has mushroomed.
And what do you think the logic is behind this?
You could speculate. More spending means more output, and that will improve the lives of New Zealanders. If you take a very benign view, spend more on the on officialdom and you'll get better outcomes. But perversely, over the last 6 years, most New Zealanders would probably feel we've moved backwards on some of the core measures.
What impact has this had on the government's books, like the surplus and the deficits we keep hearing about?
Yeah, so when the current government came to power, it inherited a five-yearly forecast which had the government books in deficit to the tune of $15 billion. By contrast, when Labor came to office in 2017, the same five-yearly forecast was for a $26 billion surplus. So that's a huge swing.
I was having a look at a graph the other day of the deficits and surpluses that New Zealand governments have had over time. And I mean, in the key English years, there were certainly deficits, weren't there?
No, there absolutely were. And that comes back to my point that New Zealand is prone to natural disasters. Of course, we had the Kaikoura and Christchurch earthquakes. The results of those are very hard for governments to grapple with. And of course, we had COVID during the Ardern government, and we had a massive increase in government spending, and especially with the wage subsidy, a scheme that we were extremely supportive of. If you're going to lock down the economy, you need to underwrite it. But after that, after COVID started to recede, most countries in the world managed to get their spending back to pre-COVID levels. Ours just kicked on. And the outcome is that in 2017, 2018, the first year of the Labor government, government spending was about $80 billion. In the current year, it's forecast to be $140 billion, so an increase of 74%. Now, you have to adjust that for inflation because the price of money's reduced, but it's still an increase in 39%.
What do you think about the arguments that a lot of people are saying that National is only cutting these people so they can pay for tax cuts and give landlords a tax break too?
What we've seen is prioritising of tax cuts for a select few and landlords as opposed to critical areas of government responsibility that New Zealanders need.
Well, the scale of public spending over 6 years, adjusted for inflation, has increased by 39% compared with where it was in 2017. The government's borrowings books have blown out. The level of Crown debt has doubled over the last 6 years. So whether there were tax cuts or not, there needed to be a scalpel taken to the size of government spending.
Now to change tack slightly, to talk about the effects on Wellington itself. Here's our final guest.
My name's Joel McManus and I'm the Wellington editor at The Spinoff.
Now, I've had a look at a lot of headlines recently about Wellington. They haven't been too kind. Been looking at things like capital crisis, retail exodus, has the sun set on Wellington? Even John Key a few years ago, and this has been in a recent story I've seen, said, all you have there is government, Victoria University and Weta Workshop. Is that fair?
I don't think that's fair. I'm a Wellington defender, and I think Wellington is increasingly diversifying its economy. It is still true that the public service is the largest employment sector by far, but you've seen a lot of growth in tech, a lot of growth in science and research, and that's really what the city needs in order so it doesn't have these big shocks whenever there's a change of government.
What's the mood of the city like at the moment?
Yeah, look, it's not good. I think everyone who either is a public servant or if you're not, you know several public servants. That's just the reality in Wellington. You might flat with them, you're probably friends with them. Everyone's worried. You know, people don't necessarily know if their job is going, but they're all thinking about it. Everyone's considering the voluntary redundancies. There's a lot of just anxiety and stress because people just don't know what the future holds.
You're not one of these journalists that flats with public servants like Nicola Willis suggested?
I think there are a few journalists in Wellington primarily, probably many of whom flat with public servants who are very focused on this.
Yeah, I flat with a public servant. Again, it's hard not to.
How reliant is Wellington really on the public service?
Well, there are 28,000 public servants working in Wellington. It is the largest sector of the economy. So that's very significant. But there's also the flow-on effects, right? We have all of these knowledge-based firms. That's kind of what the Wellington economy is built on. These are the consulting firms, the lawyers, the accountants, anyone who kind of works white-collar office jobs. And most of them are peripherally connected to the government, right? They might be working on government contracts. At the very least, they might support businesses who do or provide various services in that wider space.
Do you know, like, how much the public service is actually based in Wellington? Because there's a few in Auckland, a few in Christchurch here and there, right?
Yeah, so there's 65,000 public servants in New Zealand, 28,000 of them are in Wellington, so that's 45%. You're also seeing that there's the variety of what those public servants are, right? These cuts are focused more on back office, as Nicola Willis says, and those are more likely to be in Wellington. We're also seeing the bigger cuts happen at smaller agencies, which are more concentrated in Wellington too.
The Ministry for Pacific Peoples is having to slash nearly half its workforce as part of an order from the government to cut costs.
There's been so many headlines, terrible headlines, about how the city is so much in trouble. So what's that trouble been over recent years?
There's the same kind of trends that you're seeing everywhere, and Auckland Centre City's seen the same. Is that as the economy has shifted more and more online, there's been a slight hollowing out of those centre cities, because you don't need some of those things like retail banks, post offices. People used to go to the centre city very regularly to do their day-to-day business and admin. There's a lot of services that happened there that now happen online. So the nature of centre cities is changing. It is becoming obviously a workforce-based thing, but it also needs to adopt into this entertainment facility. People have to choose to go to the centre city because they don't have to anymore.
Well, right at the start, you talked about Wellington having to diversify its economy, right? So move more away from that public sector. Into what?
Yeah, I mean, that's the real concern in Wellington, and that's what often happens when you have capital which is not the economic capital. If the government was based in Auckland, it would not necessarily dominate the city. But in Wellington, because it's a smaller city, it has this larger impact. So to kind of survive these up and downs, Wellington needs to be better at identifying what the other industries that can grow are. Tech has been really good for Wellington. We've had Trade Me, Xero, Sharesies, Henry. FinTech especially has been really strong. And that is, again, partly because it's leaning into what Wellington already does well, which is administration, things like accountancy. We're the people who sort of tick all the boxes and make sure that the country's, you know, doing what it needs to do.
Back to Tracy Watkins from The Post.
Everyone in Wellington knows that we're in a bit of a funk at the moment, and it's a question of who you blame. Some people blame us, you know, because we run stories about the public service numbers, and we run stories about the big earthquake issues and everything, and they get concerned that we're talking the city down. I actually mentioned this in a newsletter recently and said to readers, look, you know, like, we're not trying to be negative, but we need to have a conversation so that we can talk about how to fix this. And I did actually get a lot of really positive response back from readers emailing to say, no, absolutely, these are the things we're all talking about. Something needs to happen. Wellington is definitely at a crossroads, and we need to do something about it. Coming against, you know, against that backdrop, these public service cuts are not helping.
How can we be optimistic? What's the cause for optimism in Wellington?
So it's quite interesting. When I got the job as the editor of The Post, moved back into the city because I was living in Martinborough, commuting was a little bit far. So I moved back into the central city and have totally fallen in love with it again. And there's lots of amazing things about Wellington, and you tend to forget them sometimes. It has some great entrepreneurs and innovators and hospitality venues. All the things that people love about Wellington are still there. I think we all want to have a conversation about how to make the most of it.
That's it for today. Thanks to our guests, Katie Kenny, Tracy Watkins, Roger Partridge and Joel McManus. The Detail is funded by RNZ and NZ On Air. This episode was engineered by Phil Binge. It was produced by Alexia Russell and Davina Zimmer. I'm Tom Kitchen. Ka kite anō.